Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour, please visit the webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Mogambo Guru right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, or multiplied gold, multiplied silver, multiplied herds and flocks, and great wealth. Whatever great wealth is. Well, George Bush Sr., remember that? George Bush Sr. back in 1992, and then more recently, George Bush Jr. back in 2000-2004. You know what they said? They said that what Americans want is jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, or Ben Franklin said. That isn't what Moses or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these experts, all of these professionals, all of these authorities recognize that real wealth is measured in land. It's measured in cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not now and never has been measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. There's no money in public business, and there's sure no profit or business or jobs, jobs, jobs. There's no money in employment. That's why I contend that it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the old covenant contract. And collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. In other words, collect it in real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for information on my CD Home School for Adults? That's my business school. And while you're at it, the place to start is the free General Law CD package. Free. Get that? It was free. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the international forecaster. I'm going to shift gears now. We'll shift in a second and take a look at the Richard Doughty freakishly low reserve requirement. It's a newsletter that's published once a week, comes out on Kitco Free. This week's newsletter is 9 pages long. For those of you that are poor, like I am, and you can't afford all these expensive newsletters from Queensland, Australia, and Punta Gorda, Florida. This guy, Doughty, he's also from Florida. He's one of those rich newsletter writers. Richard Doughty is called the angriest guy in economics, 9241 54th Street North, Pinellas Park, Florida, 33782. Richard Doughty, D-A-U-G-H-T-Y, 9241 54th Street North, Pinellas Park, Florida, 33782. I don't know what this guy sells. His newsletter's free. He's got a good line. He's got a good sense of humor. And he's probably one of the funniest newsletter writers in the business. He's got a good sense of humor, and you can understand everything he says. Once in a while, he uses one of those college words, you know, with four syllables, but, you know, it's very rare. And he calls himself the Mogambo Guru. That's because economists, you know, look upon themselves as being gurus. And we look upon economists as being gurus. And we go to our economists and we say, well, gee, what's the economy holding? What's going to happen next? We watch Money Watch, you know, and Wall Street Week and Paul Kangas, etc. You know, we watch PBS and these money shows, and they're all produced by the Wall Street bankers. So we get a one-sided, skewered view of economics, stocks, bonds, and they use a lot of funny words, you know, like derivatives and stocks and bonds, and we pretty well know what that is. And then they use a lot of acronyms, you know, like the TCI and the MDU, and we don't really understand what those words mean. So let's see if we can get a guy here, a guru, to tell us what's going on in the world. He starts off by saying the Treasury is back on a borrowing binge. The national debt rocketed up to $7.7 trillion, and the foreign central banks are back in the game big time as they soaked up an incredible $6.7 billion of U.S. debt in the last week alone, stashing it directly at the Fed, bringing their total to $1.4 trillion. The cover of this week's issue of Barron's magazine asks hedge funds, is the party over? If they had taken a moment to ask the Mogambo, I could have told them that the answer is no. The money that comes out of hedge funds has to go into something else. And as soon as it becomes clear that a lot of money is moving into this new thing, whatever it is, then the hedge funds will start piling into that new thing, too, whatever it is. Speaking of Barron's, I was poking around on the economic indicators page of their market laboratory section, and I noticed that total reserves in the banks is $44.5 billion. $44.5 billion. That's the total reserves in all of our banks. This is the money. This is the cash. These are the equivalents that the banks have to keep on hand in case somebody comes storming into the bank screaming, the Mogambo is right, the Mogambo is right, we're going to be freaking killed with this insanely stupid and suicidal monetary expansion of the Federal Reserve. Give me all my money so that I can go buy gold and silver with it. I mean, right now. So you look at the guy and you say, to yourself. Then you turn back to Barron's and your gaze happens to fall on that figure for savings deposited in the banks, which is $4,786.6 billion. Now, for those of you that can't count that high, that's $4.7 trillion. You know, that's for those of you that understand big numbers like trillions. Suddenly, your mind is sharpened, your nostrils flare, and you start to get really, really scared. Why? Well, this would mean, and I gulp as I say this because my mouth is dry and my heart is beating thumpity, 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 and all I want to do is run somewhere and hide. It means that the reserves that the banks are keeping on hand for you are now roughly 0.0093% of their liabilities. Well, if you prefer, it's 0.93% of liabilities, which is obviously less than 1%. You got that? 1% of even just the savings part of the bank's liabilities. Now, this is a ridiculously low, absurdly low, freakishly low reserve requirement, such that you wonder why they even bother with having a reserve requirement at all. Now, the textbook example is, and I remind our new viewers, 10%. 10%. Now, the damnable Federal Reserve has allowed the banks to have on have on hand, less than 1% of this amount. This is where all the money is coming from. All right, let me pause here, Mr. Mogambo, and let me make my comment. Years ago, when I was a young man and had plenty of money in Boise, Idaho, I used to run an operation, we used to call it a check clearing service. Actually, it was a money laundering operation where people would send me their checks from all over America, and then we would cash those checks and send them back Federal Reserve notes called money laundering. Well, Congress got onto that along with the IRS and the Federal Reserve and everybody else and said, we're going to make that a crime. We're not going to let people take other people's checks, cash them, and then send them back Federal Reserve notes, and they probably aren't paying their income tax. So they passed a law. It's called the Anti-Money Laundering Law. Put me right out of business. But I wanted to share with you a little piece of information that I discovered when I was back in the olden days, and doing business in corporate capacity in modern America in the banks. And that is, the reserve requirement at that time was 5%. 5%. Now, that was in 1982 or 3. Just before the money laundering bill came in. Now, I want to take your minds back a little further back into ancient times. See, that was the olden days, 1983. Now, back in ancient times, this is back in the 1960s, 20 years before the olden times, the reserve requirement was 17%, 16.2-thirds, I believe it was. And what that meant was the bank had to keep in the bank on hand a certain amount of money to pay the depositors. So back in the 60s, it was 16%. By the 1980s, it was 5%. Now, did you catch the Mogambo here? He says it's down to less than 1% now. So he asked the question, why have a reserve requirement at all? And the answer is, there's no point in it. We don't need a reserve requirement. And that's because nobody can go to the bank and get all of their money out anyway. And even if everybody in America said, give me my money, the banks will just hand you a deposit slip. Yeah, they'll just say, here's a cashier's check for the amount of money we owe. Now, you can take your cashier's check down the street to another Federal Reserve Bank and deposit it. How do you like that? See, back in the olden days, you know, when we still had gold and silver coin, you could go into the bank and demand your gold back. So they got rid of that gold, and then you could come into the bank and you could get your silver back. And then they got rid of the silver, and then you can come into the bank and get your Federal Reserve note back. And then they got rid of the Federal Reserve notes. Yeah, there's a few of them floating around, but by and large, 93% of all commerce done in America is done with checks and credit cards. It's not done with cash, commonly known as Federal Reserve note money. Did you know that? So I just thought I'd share that with you. So when Mogambo, see, being an old fart myself with gray hair, having lived in ancient times, olden times, and now more modern times, I can remember that reserve requirement. 16%, 5%, now it's down below 1%. You know what that says to me? That says, uh-oh, risky, you should be standing on deck all night long waiting for the Titanic to hit the iceberg. Now, Mogambo goes on and he tells us a little more. He says, I bring this up because at 0.9% reserve requirement, the reserve multiplier is thus very huge. If you walk into the bank and take a $1 bill out of your wallet, slap it on the counter, and tell the surprise teller that you want to use that dollar to make a cash deposit into your bank account, then the banks are, in effect, empowered to make available for loaning out to new borrowers more than 100 new dollars. That's 100 to 1. Isn't that just special? So when you deposit a dollar in the bank, it expands the money supply in America by $100 because by law, this is Congress now, gives the bank permission to lend out $100. Where do they get the $100 to lend out? They just create it right out of thin air because when you go into the bank and you want to make a loan, try it. Just walk into the bank and say, I want to make a loan. Fill out all the papers, and when the banker says, here, we're going to give you this $10,000 that you want to borrow, do you know what he gives you? Does he give you $10,000 in $1 bills in little piles? No, sir. Does he give you $10,000 worth of gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil? No. No, he gives you a passbook, a deposit slip. He gives you a checkbook. He gives you a piece of paper that says, go out and spend $10,000 and have a good time. That's the way that game is played. He just created that right out of thin air. Now, that's a monopoly created by Congress for a private consortium of people called international bankers. Now, many of us conservatives think that's crazy. We think it's stupid. We think it's nutso. But then, you know, those people on the other side that have the monopoly, they think that we're stupid and we're nutso because we think that those people should be using gold and silver coin instead of just creating money out of thin air and creating inflation. I mean, you know, it's just a matter of opinion. They've got theirs and we've got ours. And they're in the majority, and most of the people in America prefer the system that we have. So the conservatives come along. This is the fiscal conservatives. These are the Mogambo gurus and the George Gordons newsletter writers, the Franklin Sanders and so on, those newsletter writers and commentaries would come along and say, this is preposterous, this is crazy, you people better get a second opinion here. That's what the controversy is all about. And we're in the minority. And the majority is Wall Street Week and Money Watch and Paul Kangas on PBS. And Dan Rather and Tom Brookjaw and you know, the people on the mainstream media that are telling you about all the great things about the economy. Those are the people that are in the majority. I think that if you took a look around based upon the elections of 1992 and 1996, remember there was a guy running for office and he published a magazine called Forbes. This guy's name was Steve Forbes. He was running for president. He says, you know what we need in this country? We need to abolish the income tax and replace it with a flat tax. And the people of America did not nominate Steve Forbes. They nominated another guy in his place. You remember that? In 1996, they nominated what was his name? That senator from Kansas, Bob Dole. Remember old Bob, World War II hero? Well, Bob Dole's a great guy. We all love Bob Dole. But Bob Dole said, no, we don't want to change the income tax. We want to keep it just like it is. And Bill Clinton says, no, we don't want to change the income tax. We want to keep it just the way it is. And this flat tax idea, that's a bad idea, and we don't want it. And the people of America voted in Bill Clinton. So sent me a signal that said, well, obviously, the people of America want the income tax, the Federal Reserve, and they want more and more inflation. They just voted for it. And, you know, don't give me this so there's nobody else to vote for. I mean, go throw your vote away on some libertarian candidate or go throw your vote away on anybody else. And so you went out and you voted for a Republican or a Democrat. You voted for a red or a blue, and that's what you got. You got a red or a blue. And red and blue means we'll have more of the same. And so here comes the great Mogambo along here, and he says, did you know that the bank's reserve requirement is down to a paltry 1%? Less than 1%? That means that the banks could not possibly pay off all of their creditors. They can't even pay off all you depositors. Look at this. They got $44 billion worth of assets, and they've got $4.5 trillion worth of deposits. They can't even come close. It's not even in the game. Put another way, it'd be like you taking a dollar and you can collect 1 cent on your dollar, 1%. And by the way, I might mention this to you also, and that is that all of the goods and services that are available for sale today in America represent 2% of all the money that's out there. Now, that was before this latest binge. It's probably less than that now. Which means that if everybody in America just took the money that he's got in his pocket or in his checking account and went into Walmart, you'd clean all the shelves out. Everybody in America does this. You could get 2 cents on the dollar. That's it. That's all that's available. So this concept that I've expressed in the past, that you should probably have a 4-year supply of food on hand. You need to be free and clear. You need to own it. Bought and paid for. Well, I know that's a wild new concept, but if you take all of your money and you wait because you say, well, I've got the money and I'll go down to the warehouse and convert that to hillbilly bread and biscuits and butter and milk and eggs when I need it, My friends, you may go down there to the store and find out that you've got lots of money, but there aren't any goods to buy. Now, that's what we were faced with in 1943, 1944, 1945 during rationing in World War II. We all had plenty of money, but you just had to have the right ration card, the right buttons, and the right stamps in order to get anything. Rationing. That's what's coming. Get ready for it. Like all communist nations, America, now that we have gone communist, will have the opportunity to stand in line and share the shortage. That's what communism is all about. That's what communism does best. Stand in line and share the shortage. Now, Mugambo says, I bring this up because with 0.9% requirement, the banks can take the balance of that money. Take a $1 bill from you, convert that into $100, and lend that out at 10% interest. Take $1, lend out $100 at 10%. The bank makes $10, and all you gave them was a dollar. Well, where does all this money come from? He goes on to say, I also noted that the banks hold almost $1.2 trillion worth of government debt. It's not just foreign banks that are stupidly accumulating all of this U.S. government debt, which will fall in value as interest rates rise. But added together, $1.4 trillion and $1.2 trillion, this comes to $2.6 trillion, which is about 25% of the entire gross domestic product of the United States of America. And this behavior by the banks brings up the point that I am always screeching about, and it's always the same thing that causes economic slowdowns and problems and recessions and depressions and collapses. The banks acted stupidly and greedy. Stupid and greedy banks cause the problem. I'll just couple that with your politicians, would you? Now, Stephen H., who prefers to be characterized as alert reader, says that in reference to a comment last week about high interest rates, Montana already has an 11% top rate, and it starts at only $76,199. I'll bet they can't figure out why no one who makes any money wants to live there in Montana. What a bunch of morons. Okay, well, I'm sure that a few of you listeners up there in Montana are probably listening to this program. Get your pen and paper out, boys and girls. Sharpen your pencil on both ends. Are you ready to copy this down? If you're making $100,000 a year up in Montana, the U.S. government wants $17,000 of it. That's the income tax. Then they want $16,000 of it. That's the Social Security tax. And then the state of Montana wants $11,000 of it because that's their tax rate. Now add that up. 7 and 6 is 13. 1 is 14. 1, 2, 3, 4. That's 44%. Now let me ask you this. What is it that the state of Montana, along with George Bush and the neocons, giving you for which you would give them 44% of everything that you create and produce? Have you ever stopped to think about that? I got into that dilemma some years back when I was producing. I used to be a producer. I used to be in the furniture business, and I produced furniture, and I produced about $100,000 a month worth of furniture. That was about $1 million a year, a little more. So I produced $1 million a year, and when I got through paying all of my expenses and taxes and overhead and fines and late penalties and dues and one thing and another, when it was all said and done, I made about $100,000 a year. I got about 10% out of the whole ball of wax. And the government got $200,000. The government got twice as much as I did. And I asked myself a hard question. I said, now what in the hell is the government doing for me for which they take half of everything that I create and produce? And they take theirs first. Then after they take theirs first, then I have to go out and pay all the bills and the payroll and buy the materials and go out and sell the product. And when I get all through doing all of that, I couldn't think of anything that the government was doing for me. And they said, well, we're protecting you from the communists. We're protecting you from the communists. And that was 1983 when, or 1980, 1978, you know, that was when We Americans had embraced all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. We Americans, we practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Did you know that? The 10th plank, public schools. 5th plank, central bank. 2nd plank, progressive income tax. 8th plank, social security. I mean, you know, come on, boys and girls. 4th plank, confiscation of all the property of immigrants and rebels. Does the IRS confiscate anybody's property? Have you got Homeland Security? And anti-drug czars that just take people's cars and houses and property because they accuse them of being terrorists or dealing in drugs. I mean, you know, all 10 planks to the manifesto are being practiced here in America, have been for the last 30 or 40 years or more. So he goes on to say, so we see that Montana has political morons too, which proves that stupidity seems to be like God. Everywhere, all at once. Which brings up a crypto quote from James Fiebelman, which recently appeared in my hometown newspaper. And it reads, you can say one thing about ignorance. There seems to be more than enough to go around. Now, speaking of alert readers, David B.C. sent a link about Paul McCulley of PIMCO, who is commenting about what is referred to as the Bretton Woods 2 system, which is, according to Marshall Auerbach of the Prudent Bear website, posits the notion that the world is effectively back to a regime of global fixed exchange rates pegged to the U.S. dollar, like the original Bretton Woods regime, which lasted from 1945 to 1973. Mr. McCulley writes, by linking mercantilist emerging market countries, notably China, into a de facto monetary union with the United States represents a positive shock to global aggregate supply relative to global aggregate demand. Well, Magombo says, not necessarily, because it would take a willingly stupid U.S. consumer to go into debt to buy the new supply of goods and services. But as it turns out, Americans did act willingly, and they did act stupidly. What luck for these foreigners. Anyway, it is the next part that makes me foam at the mouth and stick pins into a voodoo doll. Consequently, Mr. McCulley writes, it is America's global civic duty to live beyond its means, and it is the Federal Reserve's global civic duty to facilitate American hedonism, because in the face of a positive structural shock to global aggregate supply, notably labor, American hedonism is not inflationary. My mouth is hanging open in stupefaction, says Magombo. Well, I will agree that a glut of supply does not necessarily lead to higher prices immediately, but I'm here to tell you that the weird economic distortions and malinvestments of such a shocked system will, sooner or later, have to be paid for in one way or another, because that's the way that economics works. But nowadays, that is considered to be a matter of opinion. Well, I guess it is. Sort of like how everybody says that I am very weird, stupid, and a hateful little drunken bastard, and I disagree, and I tell them, I am not drunk. Told you Magombo had a little sense of humor, didn't I? Well, listen to this. But it is that part about our civic duty to go into debt that makes me, I'm looking for the right word. Crazy? Is that the right word? Crazy? Well, this horrid little McCulley putz, and those words came immediately to my lips, actually says that it is our damned obligation to go into bankrupting ourselves and bankrupting levels of debt. We have a duty to consume more, he says, more than we can pay for. And if we decide to go into the business of making lousy chocolate pies, it is automatically the duty and obligation of my neighbors to buy those pies, eat those pies, and then borrow more money to buy those pies. And the bank has an obligation to loan them the money to buy the pies, Wow. It's a good thing that this McCulley dude is good at managing a bond portfolio, because the career options for what appears to be a mentally ill socialist crackpot who declares that an entire country has an obligation to live beyond its means, and that it is similarly the duty of the central banks of that country to provide the financing for such gluttonous excess, regardless of the consequences, must be very limited indeed, as I have never seen a help wanted classified ad where anybody was looking for one of those asses, and as a mentally ill crackpot myself, I happen to be somewhat of an expert in that particular employment area. You know, we're getting to the point where George Orwell, you know, got to this doublespeak. I mean, we've gotten to the point where we can't even hold a conversation. Americans have just plain gone nuts. And this guy, McCulley here, is an economist of some kind. Hang on a second. I've got to give you a reminder here and a disclaimer so that nobody thinks that this crazy crackpot law hour has anything to do with the management or the staff of the radio station. So remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the law hour and editorial review, then please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. While you're at it, why don't you ask for the free general law CD package? Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, call the law school at 417-273-4967. And keep in mind that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school or the Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, I've done my duty for the FCC and my advertisers and sponsors and local radio stations so that you don't get mad and blame them and turn the radio off and quit listening to good music. Mogambo goes on to say, can you cite another time in all of history when anybody ever said it is the duty of a nation to live beyond its means and to borrow and then consume to the limits of our greedy imaginations? And assuming that there is actually some precedent for this gleaned from some backward little enclave of economically ignorant dirtbags in the forgotten backwaters of economic history, how did it work out? What was the final conclusion to the experiment? I'm asking because I've never, ever read about such a thing happening. I've never heard of such a thing happening. In fact, I've never heard of anyone ever saying something as crazy as that has ever happened. Never. Never. Only now, in 2005, for the first time in all of history, we've got a guy saying that we owe it to the world to plunge ourselves into ever more debt, day after day, month after month, year after year. It boggles your damn mind, doesn't it? It must be a weird, mutant variety of Keynesian stupidity taken to new extremes or something. Or perhaps Mr. McCulley is extrapolating beyond Mr. Auerbach's comment that implicit in the Bretton Woods II model is that the presumption is that the arrangement is symbiotic and mutually beneficial for everybody. But perhaps if Mr. McCulley was not so anxious to make a fool of himself, he would have heard that Mr. Auerbach said next, as he goes on to immediately say, quote, ironically, the very aspect of Bretton Woods II lauded by exponents as introducing the virtues of a quasi-fixed exchange rate system has, in fact, propagated enormous international imbalances, the unwinding of which will almost certainly be hugely destabilizing. God, that sounds like old Alan Greenspan. you know, with his exuberance. Well, this guy here, he says, it must be a weird and mutant variety of Keynesian stupidity taken to new extremes or something. And he says, the unwinding of the economy will almost certainly be hugely destabilizing. If that isn't an understatement, I don't know what is. I mentioned to you in the last program, and I saw on TV the other night, this couple up in Chicago buying a $300,000 condominium, interest only, for 5 years, signed a 30-year note. 4.53% interest going in. The interest goes up, or the payments go up from $1,400 a month to $1,700, and then to $2,500. And this guy assumes that the economy is going to go on forever. He's a doctor. He goes to medical school. When this kid gets out of medical school, he's going to have letters after his name. This guy's going to be somebody. He's going to be smart. He's going to have a degree from college that says he's a doctor. People are going to look up to him. They're going to say, doctor, doctor. See? Well, I'm just an old country boy, and I'd say that doctor can't count. That's my conclusion. And for us little guys down here, you know, us truck drivers and farmers, and the guys that are out here, blue-collar guys, you know, they're just out here working, making a living. When this economy goes, we're going to have a hard time making ends meet. And I'm saying you're going to have a hard time making ends meet if you're free and clear. What the hell are you going to do with a mortgage? What are you going to do with car payments? What are you going to do with all those gadget payments that you're making to Beneficial Finance? Now, boys and girls, I'd say it's time for us to take a sober look at the world. And I don't know how much time we got left. A year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, I don't know. I'm surprised that it's gone this far. I can hardly believe that you could run this far into debt and that people would actually buy your paper and still do business with you. I can't tell you of a single businessman who, if we took the numbers that the U.S. government is using and just dropped those numbers down to thousands of dollars instead of trillions, that would do business with George Gordon if I was running my business the way the U.S. government's running theirs. And I reported to you last time or time before here about where General Motors is going. Now, General Motors is planning a bankruptcy. They have been for 15 years. And I'll bet you there's people out there buying and selling General Motors stock today, out there on the stock market. There's people out there buying General Motors bonds, junk bonds, out there today in the marketplace. I don't know where those people's heads are, but, you know, for an old country boy like me, I wouldn't touch that crap with a 10-foot pole. I wouldn't take it if you gave it to me. I don't want the commercial paper, number one. I don't want the taxes to go along with it, number two. Well, Mugambo goes on to say, or perhaps the words of Eric J. Fry, who writes the Rude Awakening column, maybe he can explain the errors of such irresponsible socialization. So Fry writes, quote, as we pile up these foreign debts, we're also piling up liabilities that must be socialized away. We must all, collectively, all Americans, satisfy the cost of our excesses either through taxation or currency debasement or both. Well, Warren Buffett, you know this Warren Buffett guy? He's a pretty smart guy. He's got labels and he's got letters after his name, and he buys and he sells and he does all these things. He invests and does all this kind of thing. Well, old Buffett bought, I forgot how much it was. I think it was something like $100 million worth of silver and then stashed it over in Britain. Yeah, he's one of the insider bankers. He's one of these insider investors. You know, he's got $20, $30, $40 billion. He's got more money than he's got sense, and he's no dummy. At least he's smart enough to buy a little gold and silver, at least a little silver that we know of. Yeah, that ought to send you a little signal, shouldn't it? Now, we've got some excesses going, and we've got some currency debasement. Now, this guy Buffett said that he's getting out of dollars and into euros and Swiss francs and Russian rubles and other currencies. Does that send you a signal? Does that tell you something? Does this tell you something that Money Watch, Wall Street Week, and Paul Kangas hasn't mentioned? You know, my common sense says, hey, listen, if some of these, if these big rats are leaving the ship, maybe us little rats ought to think about getting away off of here, too. Well, Mike C., who's another alert reader, who was driven to comment on my boring, predictable, and overly strident denunciation of the stupidity of anyone wanting to have constant inflation, as the horrid Ben Bernanke and other fellow traveler central banking morons advocate. He writes that South Africa, where he lives, has a central bank that is happy with 3.8% year-on-year inflation. In fact, those South African central bank boneheads are already targeting inflation like the asinine Bernanke advocates, and he writes their CPIX target is range of 3-6%. Well, let me pause here for a moment, Mr. Magombo, and let me editorialize for a minute. 3% inflation is what I call the half-life of your money, every 25 years. So if we have optimum inflation, and government politicians tell us that the optimum economic model is to have 3% inflation per year. Well, if you take $100 and you put it in the bank and you inflate your money by 3%, you've got $97 worth of purchasing power. So you went out and you worked and you made $100. So you gave $100 worth of effort, put it in the bank, and you get $97 worth of purchasing power. And then the next year you lose 3% of $97, and then the next year you lose 3% of that, and so on down the line. And it's called compound interest. For you boys and girls out there, that's a college word. That's one of those big multi-syllable words. Compound interest. That means that we charge you the interest on the interest. And when you do that 25 times, that's 25 years in a row, your $100 will have $50 worth of purchasing power. Now, somebody that did some watching, and here's what they figured. After having watched all of these gurus, they said, if you can average 5% return on your money, you are in fat city. At compound interest, 5% doubles every 14.7 years. So put $100 in the bank at 5% interest, and in 14.7 years, you'll have $200 in the bank. Now, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. But from 1960 through the year 2000, that 40-year period, the average inflation rate was 4.7%. So that means that if you were getting your 5% from 1960 to 2000, and you had $100 in the bank in 1960, in the year 2000, you would have been just about at the break-even point. You would have collected enough interest to keep the same purchasing power as you had in 1960. And remember, your money doubles every 14 years. Round that off to 15, 30, 45, it would double three times. So you got $300 in the bank, and it takes $300 in purchasing power to equal what $100 would buy in 1960. So you didn't gain anything. You didn't make any profit, but you didn't lose anything, and you held your own. And that's if you could average 5% every year, compounded for 40 years. Not very many people can do that. All right, boys and girls, there's more. For us, it is with everybody such a, or as it is with everybody, such a suicidal plan would dictate a constant devaluation of the dollar, which means a constant lessening of buying power, which means that prices constantly go up and up, which means that tempers go up and up, and pretty soon the world is awash with unions on strike demanding higher pay, and those existing on government handouts demanding more money, everybody needing more money, lots more money, but nobody is getting more money, much less lots more money, and the government responds by creating more money and more credit, monetary inflation, which makes the price inflation even worse. Thus, everybody is grumpy as hell and getting grumpier every day. And while I am not an expert on the subtleties of the Elliott Wave theories, one salient aspect is that nations that are grumpy do not prosper, the Magombo says. nations that are grumpy do not prosper. And although there is some debate as to which causes which, please use your sharply honed SAT test-taking skills and parse the previous sentence to determine if posterity and grumpiness are 1, mutually exclusive, 2, coincident, or 3, both of the above, 4, neither of the above, or 5, who the hell cares? The answer for you and me, as mere mortals who are grumpy, is 1. The answer for the government and the central banks and the monstrously huge, huge, unbelievably huge financial services interest, the answer is obviously 5. Who in the hell cares? Well, paying attention here, boys and girls. By the way, this is called the Magombo Guru Report. I'm going to pause right here and tell you where you can get this. It comes free. This is a 9-page report. Kind of a humorous story is what it is. 9-page report that comes from Kitco.com. So if you just hit Kitco.com, I think that you could hit exclusive commentaries. And this one is called the Richard Doughty, D-A-U-G-H-T-Y, the Magombo Guru, June 1st, 2005. Also, you can go to www.dailyreckoning.com. I mean, this guy might have something to do with the dailyreckoning.com. And I imagine he's actually got a newsletter to sell, and I imagine he's probably got gold and silver to sell, and I imagine he's probably a pretty nice guy, and you'd probably like to go to dinner with him and pick his brain and find out what else he knows. Meanwhile, back on the farm, can you cite another time in all of history when anybody ever said it's the duty of a nation to live beyond its means? You know, in the past, when nations lived beyond their means, like the Roman Empire, they go into national captivity. Do you suppose that the American Empire could, well, the American superpower, they call them now. In the old days, they used to call them empires. Today, we call them superpowers. Do you suppose that maybe the great American superpower could self-destruct, be conquered, like the Roman Empire, by the barbarians in China and Russia? Or the Middle East? Could that happen to us? Well, I'm betting on it. And perhaps that's what has led Dan Denning of Strategic Investments to make this comment. He said, liquidity, simply speaking, is the flow of cash and credit through a financial system. When you have more savings and or you have more credit in an economy than there are productive places to invest them, you get a bubble. It's called too much money chasing too few goods or opportunities. The prudent monetary policy in such situations is to take your medicine and tighten credit. Greenspan, for the most part, has done the opposite. He has flooded the U.S. financial system with excess liquidity, in the process creating bull markets or bubbles in stocks, real estate, and bonds, while fostering a related bubble, and in consumption, the symptom of which is a huge trade deficit. Well, that's where we're at today. They tell us now that this trade deficit is going to move from $600-700 billion a year to $900 billion next year, 2006. Gosh, if we can borrow $900 billion in 2006, could we borrow $1 trillion or $1.1 trillion in 2007? I mean, pretty soon maybe we could get up to borrowing $2 trillion in 5 or 10 years, and then $3 trillion, and then $5 trillion and $6 trillion. I mean, is there ever any end to this? If your house is worth $500,000 today, will it be worth $1 million in 3 or 4 or 5 years? Then $2 million, $5 million, $10 million? And you know, the truth is, it's going to have more dollars worth of value to it, but what are those dollars going to buy? Has anybody ever stopped to figure that out? Are you going to end up, now, you know, 5 years from now, with a $1 million house that buys less than your $500,000 house buys today? See, we got a bread here called hillbilly bread, and they sell it for $1 a loaf. It's worth every penny of it. You get this white wallpaper paste for $1 a loaf, and people, they just love it. It's like eating Twinkies, Ho-Hos, and Ding-Dongs, I guess. I haven't eaten it, but it sells like hotcakes, $1 a loaf. So I just kind of figured, I said, well, shucks. if it's worth $500,000, you know, take your house. It's worth $500,000 today. That's 500,000 loaves of hillbilly bread, right? All right. Now, let's expand your house until it's now worth $1 million 5 years from now. Do you think hillbilly bread's still going to be selling for $1 a loaf? Because if it's selling for 50 cents a loaf, you haven't gained or lost anything. But what if it's selling for 60 or 70 cents a loaf? You've actually lost ground. You made $500,000 more. Now, here's the kicker. Let's say you bought a house for $100,000, and today it's worth $500,000. You could sell it, make a $400,000 profit, 400,000 loaves of hillbilly bread. Now pay your taxes and dues and all the rest of it, and maybe you might net $100,000 or $200,000. You actually move from 100,000 loaves of hillbilly bread to 200,000 or 300,000 loaves. Now hang on to it for 5 years until it goes up to $1 million. Then sell it. Won't your tax bracket be higher? Will the capital gains tax be higher or lower? Will the property taxes and the upkeep and the interest payments that you're making over the next 5 years compensate you adequately for the amount of purchasing power that you're going to lose over the next 5 years? Has anybody ever figured purchasing power? I know they tout these stocks all the time, and so I had one of our researchers run in. I said, well, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, there's 30 stocks that they average. Go get that for me. So he came back, and he had a pile of paper, and I started going through it. Do you know there was only four profitable companies in there? General Motors, General Electric, Microsoft, and Walmart. Microsoft and Walmart weren't paying any dividends, so they just take your money. When you invest $10,000 in Microsoft and Walmart, they take your money and they go spend it and build more stores and expand their operation. So you hope that your stock is going to be worth more next year. General Motors and General Electric were both paying dividends of about 5%. Now remember, inflation is running 12% now. That was last year when they told us that inflation was well under control. It was only half that last year. Boys and girls, inflation has been running ahead of. That is, the actual cost of the goods and services that we buy actually have been running ahead of the dividends that are being paid by these multinational corporations that we've been taught that if you're getting 5%, you're in fat city. And I want to tell you, boys and girls, as an old country boy, I wouldn't get out of bed for 5%. Wouldn't get out of bed for 5%. The money is made in buying, selling, and trading. And we call it keystoning. And if I buy something for a dollar, I want to sell it for two. That's called the 2% principle. Always remember that, the 2% principle. My wife was explaining that to a Jewish fellow from New York. He was on the telephone. And he asked my wife, he said, what kind of a profit margin do you expect in your school? And she said, 2%. We buy it for a dollar, we sell it for two, and we make it on that 2%. And he just went ballistic. He said, no, that's 100%. That's a 50% mark. And she said, huh? Now you're getting into high finance over here. We're just simple country folk, and we make it on that 2%. So I want to advocate that, and that's what I advocate here in my business school. We deal in gold and silver coin, and we work on the 2% principle. Pays better than that 5% dividend from General Motors, I'll tell you. Now, Magamba goes on to say, what we need, we tell one another in a way to make some fast money on this. Looking to the Magamba for an answer is, as he has been proved, a total waste of time, so where do we turn? Well, to our good fortune, Mr. Deming has the answer. But for traders, there may be a profitable solution to the liquidity black hole problem. If you could quickly and easily buy volatility in the options market, you could buy the one thing that will go up in a liquidity crisis. You'd want to buy the fear gauge, better known as the volatility index 14. But before you run to the phone to pick up some 14, he goes on to say, that's the VIX, I guess it is, the Chicago Board Options Exchange, called the CBOE, Chicago Board Options Exchange, was scheduled to begin trading options on two separate VIX-related indexes in late April. But as usual with a new product, the launch date was missed. CBOE hasn't said when the VIX options will start trading. Apparently, the symbol for the two of the first VIX products will be VBX and VBI. Well, Rob Peebles, writing on the PrudentBear.com site, says that the Japanese Nikkei and the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond yields track each other. So I see a flurry of hands go up as we all are scratching our heads and quizzically asking ourselves, the Japanese stock market and the American 10-year T-bonds are coincident? Now, why would stock prices all the way over in Japan be so closely correlated to U.S. bond yields? Without even bothering to let us ask the question, Mr. Peebles breezily goes on to note that Michael Pinsner, he's the author of The New Laws of the Stock Market Jungle, wonders if it's because when the Japanese invest in our U.S. bonds to support the dollar versus the yen and to take up the slack from the financial imbalances, they divert funds from their domestic equity market and vice versa. Well, that's the way it used to be. But with central banks no longer willing to loan us so much money, who knows anymore? Now, I reported to you from the International Investor that the Federal Reserve has a bunch of shell corporations down here in the Caribbean that are buying up these treasuries. So when they put these out for auction, you know, we expect the Central Bank of Germany and the Central Bank of China and the Central Bank of Japan to come into these auctions and buy these treasury bills. Well, they quit doing that. China and Japan dropped out. They quit. So now all of a sudden in their place we find that there are Caribbean banks and British banks that are buying it all up. Oh, really now? Really? Those treasury bills must really be rare. They must be very, very valuable. The rarer something is, the more valuable it becomes. Now, you got the Federal Reserve that's out here printing up money, bonds, and pieces of paper and selling them on the world market just as fast as they can print them. Do you think there's any shortage of dollars in the world? Talk about money manipulation. Now, for those of us like me who are anxiously waiting for gold to shoot to the moon, Mike Swanson offers this. He says, three signs of a gold bottom. First off, he notes that the divergence between the gold stock index and gold reached an extreme level. The action in gold stocks tends to lead the action in the metal. When gold stocks outperform gold, it has historically been bullish for both the stocks and the metal. However, when the stocks trade weaker than gold, a correction is usually near. In particular, he monitors the gold stock ratio. And when this ratio is rising, he writes, gold stocks are outperforming gold, and when it is falling, gold stocks are trading weaker than the metal, which is called bearish. Now, here's where we're going to stop, boys and girls, with this little story on gold. We'll be back here next time to tell you about how to figure that the economy is on the verge of collapse based upon the signals that it's sending. That's called the Mugambo Guru. Well, we've got to stop right here. I want you to remember that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, just go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, where we take up the Mugambo Guru. God willing, of course. So until then, Good night, friends.